This is Spectrum West. Al Ross is on vacation this week. I'm Dean Kallenbach. We talk each week to the people who produce the art, the music, the literature, the theater that make living here special, even when it's below zero. We wrap up the first month of 2014 with a look back at some of the more interesting people we talked to in 2013. We'll be hearing from Max Garland, Wisconsin's Poet Laureate, and Al's interview with him right after he received the honor. We'll also remember Jim Oliver's interview with author Calista Gingrich, the Whitehall native, who has a famous politician for a husband. We've got musicians on the show, too, as we sample some music from the sister act, the Ericksons, and share a snippet from an interview in May with Eau Claire's famous native son, Justin Vernon. Last October, though, Al sat down with a man who crosses the line between music and art. Al went to visit Eric Lee at his Eau Claire studio, where he creates paintings but also has developed the art of drum making. Al opened by asking Eric Lee whether he creates, builds, or makes his snare drums.
I don't know. I guess I just make a drum.
You just make a drum.
Yeah.
But see, you're an artist, so where do the two meet when you're building a snare drum?
Well, I guess in the design and then the sound. You know, it's funny, a lot of people, they want to make the sound the primary thing about a drum, and I guess it has to be. That's its purpose, right? But for me, it's about how it looks, how it feels, what it does for the person who's playing it, if it meets their sort of expectations and personality, not to mention their music style and how they play. I'll put it this way. I'm not a science-minded guy, so I don't do a lot of one-to-one comparisons between one drum or another, mm-hmm. or even one kind of wood and another. I have a handle on the basics and then just go from there. Mm-hmm. So it's more of an art, I guess, in that regard.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Because you're an artist, how a drum sounds is important, but then again, you just answered my question about it has to look good in order to be something that comes from your shop. Do people come to you and tell you exactly what kind they want or what they want in it or what they want it to sound like, what they want it to look like to match the personality thing you were talking about?
Yeah, sometimes that happens. I've had everything from having a few on stock where someone likes it and they'll buy that one, to having a guy want to have his hands in every bit of the build, at you know, every aspect of the build process. So, well, there's one over here that's for a guy in Georgia that's going to be leaving this week, and he designated that he wanted rock maple and black walnut striped, and he designated the dimensions of the drum, the depth, the diameter, what kind of bearing edge, the hardware. So it was up to me to put all those things together. And then he asked for advice along the way, you know, what would this do? Let's say the venting, what kind of vent would you recommend if I wanted this sound quality or if I wanted this kind of characteristic out of the drum? But he had a good idea already, and he even designed his own badge for that one.
All right, so let's go back to the beginning. Eric Lee, drums, where's that come from?
I've played drums for, well, I don't know, since I was a kid, I guess. Was in the La Crosse Blue Stars as well for just one season, a drum corps. Got to know the snare drum as a unique thing. Mm-hmm. But then more recently, I used to move around a lot and had to dump my kit and only went around with a practice pad for years and years. And when I got back to Eau Claire and started school here, I wanted to get going and playing again and didn't have any drums. I just had a couple of bits laying around. So I went on eBay, got a shell, and started actually assembling drums from raw shells. And I learned right there I like that about as much as I like playing them, maybe even a little more, really. And one thing led to another, and the big opportunity for me actually was I got the drum tech for Bon Iver. There's no better learning experience than, you know, going around the country at different venues with top flight players and top flight audio equipment and drums, mm-hmm. and getting to hear how all these things relate to the audience and to the audio engineers, to the people playing them, to the musicians on stage. There's no comparison. You can't do that anywhere else.
For those people out there who don't know what a drum tech is, tell us what a drum tech does.
Anything from getting the equipment, the drums off the truck, to setting them up and tuning them, to just sort of maintaining them in general, making sure everything's tight so there's no mishaps playing, you know, live. But mostly it's keeping them tuned to both the player and to the audio engineer and what they want to get out of the drums for that room. So it's sort of taking the temperature of a room. Well, everything figures into this. This was a summer tour, and so there was humidity and heat issues. It was whether it was indoors or outdoors. The room itself, how large it was, how hard it was. The engineer, Brian Joseph, would go around with some device that I frankly don't know what it's called, and he would sort of take the temp of the room. And this did relate also to how the drums would react. Also, the drums would change their personality as they would warm up throughout the day, or cool off, as it might be. If they're in the truck, let's say it's 90 degrees outside, you bring them into an air-conditioned theater, they're going to change. And so you have to be able to adjust and make them sound good. And basically, try not to be a headache for the audio engineers is the whole goal. Less on their plate. I mean, if they're running 70, 80 channels, they don't want to have to be concerned with like an annoying snare drum or a drum that just is ringing sympathetically because it's not, you know, it's too tight in frequency to the other drums, or misbehaving. They don't want to have to deal with it. So the best you can get it tuned up so that they don't have to worry about it, that's kind of the goal.
Eric Lee, our guest on Spectrum West, and he and I are standing in his workshop. He's been on the program as an artist in the past, but today we're talking about his proficiency for building drums. Are you sort of surprised at, I can use the word success, I mean, you get somebody from Georgia ordering one.
Well, yeah, actually I am. I'm pretty crummy at advertising and PR stuff, whatever it's called. I'm just not too good at that. I have a website and a Tumblr and a Facebook, and that's it.
And today, that's almost all. That's all you need.
Yeah, well, lucky for me, I guess. But there's been a lot of local support. I mean, there's been a lot of buyers around here. And look, they don't have to buy what I'm building. They could go to any music store or a guitar center. They could order online. I mean, most people order online. Even instruments they haven't heard before. That's sort of becoming the norm. So it's been really great.
Now, a snare drum is made up of a lot of components, and I think your art is in the body of it, the wood part. You have components that you have to shop for. How do you know what to get and where to get them?
Yeah, well, I've tried and continue to try different things, but I've sort of looked all over online when it comes to hardware, lugs, hoops, things that I don't right now build myself, generally called hardware, and I've sort of narrowed it down to what I consider to be the highest quality stuff that I personally can find. And it also depends on budgets. If, let's say, a drummer wants something, but they have only X amount to spend, well, how I have it set up is I get X amount for a shell bill, and I make them aware of what the shell costs, and then how they want to option it up from there is completely up to them, and they know where their money's going then. And that's how I send estimates and invoices, is so they know exactly where it's going. I don't charge a penny for hardware. So if they want to opt for a dollar lug versus a $7, $8 lug, you know, that keeps the cost down. If I build them myself, I tend to go on the higher side, the more higher quality side and the more unique side. There's a number of drum builders out there, so I'm trying to distinguish myself with designs and combinations so that it's a little bit different when they get something from me.
Is a whole set of drums in your plan someday?
Well, you know, yeah. I just finally got around to modifying my cheap lathe, so now it has a much
better... And we're looking at it as we talk.
Yeah, it doesn't look like a lot, but it finally now has it where it counts, I guess. It's got a variable speed motor, which means I'm not taking my life into my hands now. I can control things and get just a lot more precision and fine-tuning out of this thing. And also means I can turn pretty much anything I want. Right now, I'm focusing on the snare drum still, but I do have plans. They're all ready to go. I just need to do it.
How about woods? Where do you get those from?
Yeah, that's kind of fun. I've got them everywhere from reclaimed wood, from old granaries. This guy right here.
It has kind of a checkerboard pattern.
This one is built for a jazz player, J.T. Bates. He's in Minneapolis. This is made almost entirely out of 700- to 800-year-old oak from the Globe Elevator in Superior, Wisconsin.
No kidding.
So it's a very interesting, and for my money, one of the best-sounding snare drums I've ever
Did he request that?
Yeah, he approached me because I was making it known that I wanted to do more reclaimed wood drums. Yeah, that was the selling point for him. And since then, I've had a lot more requests for that. So I'm going to be making a trip up there and getting more of that wood. They come in huge blocks, so I actually have to hand saw them and get them all ready first. Then I plane them, then they go into a drum.
And that's close to your heart.
Yeah, definitely. That's it's as close as it gets because that's sort of my old stomping ground. So, and I was very happy to find that it sounds good. It would have been a disappointment if it sort of, you know, sucked. But
yeah, that's true.
It sounds very good.
So a lathe. I'm trying to envision what do you need a lathe for in making a drum?
What I make are segmented or stave style drums, which means think of a whiskey barrel, okay? They have vertical running, grain-oriented vertically drums that are glued end-to-end into a circle. And then you throw them on the lathe and mill them down. and that's how you get your roundness. And the same goes for segmented. And segmented drums, which is this kind of drum here from the Globe Elevator, is where the grain's running horizontally, and that's more of a block pattern. Basically the same concept, but there are differences in sound and look. You run into all sorts of issues. I've had to overcome, the first year to year and a half of doing this, I ran into all sorts of problems. I had to get real creative. What I guess that's code for not having the money to do it right. Or I couldn't get the good equipment, so I had to come up with a way to make it happen with stuff I could afford. It's been working out real well. And the whole name of the game now is refining it, getting the basics to the point where it's second nature, and then I get to play around with design more, and that's where I'm at right now.
You are a pretty accomplished visual artist as well, and obviously there's a visual side to your snare drums. I see some work here. Are you still able to do the visual arts, and how do you allot time for each one? I suppose snare drum orders come in and you have to fill them.
Yeah, it's a balancing act, that's for sure. I have a show in Hudson right now for the paintings, a big show at the Phipps. I have a smaller show here in Eau Claire right now, and I have a couple orders that I have to get ready right now for drums. So I've been lucky, if you could put it that way, in the timing. As it's been, I'll usually have a dry spell on the painting, and then it starts to, come in for the drums. So, yeah, it's a balancing act. They each take a lot of time. I can say, though, for the drum thing, the name of the game is to refine it, but also to get it more efficient so that I can, for basic designs anyway, knock them out a little more efficiently. It took me well over a month to get something where I needed it to be, and now I can do it in probably a week and a half for a shell. And way better than I used to be able to do it.
What do you have to know about the rest of a person's kit to build a snare that fits it?
Generally, if I have a handle on what they're playing and talk to them for a little while, then I know where they're coming from. It's it's funny, over the past couple few years, it only takes a conversation or two to know where they're coming from. So usually it has to do with what they're playing and who they are. And I have, by the way, before I do anything for a drummer, if I'm building them one, I have to get to know them a little. I can't just build them one and hope for the best. They have to tell me as much as they can about what they want and who they are. And yeah, actually, I do ask them what kind of kit they're running with, and that right there tells me the character. It's funny. It's kind of like car guys.
Yeah.
Not much difference, really.
Are they all the same size? Number one, that's the first part of the question. And number two, is there a difference between old snare drums and new snare drums, what they're expected to do?
Yeah, there's big differences. There's a huge thing with vintage gear these days where it's to the point where some of the major manufacturers are trying to emulate the old building techniques of, say, the 30s, but mostly 40s, 50s, and 60s. This is mostly for guys who are going for the quote vintage sound. And what that means is thinner walls and reinforcement rings, basically the only way they built drums for decades, but that drum companies throughout the 80s, 90s until now hadn't really been doing anymore. So if people wanted that classic rock sound, say from the 60s, or if they wanted a classic jazz sound from the 60s or 50s or something, they'd have to get vintage gear. But now there's a number of companies that are emulating that. So back to your first question of depths and sizes. Mike Malone right now is requesting a 13-inch diameter drum. That's a little smaller than the standard. Most drums are 14 for snare drums. And because it's smaller, it's going to have a little more pop, a little more high end. But that's just one of its traits. Depth figures in what kind of bearing edges, those who don't know what those are, that's what the drum head itself sits on around the rim of the drum. That's where the wood comes into contact with the drum head. That determines it, the kind of wood, the kind of hoops, what kind of vents are involved in the drum, because the air cushion inside a snare drum is very important to how the drum sounds. All these things figure in.
Snare drum 101, let's give people an idea of what's inside a snare drum. There is a lever that allows them to become a snare drum, and it's kind of a sizzle type thing.
They're called snares. Back in the old days, they were made out of anything from string to catgut. Typically, for most drum set players, it's steel or brass coils. They're engaged or disengaged with what's called a throw-off lever on the snare drum, and that means you have them on, which you get a snare drum sound, or you have them off, which means you get more of a, basic right. drum sound. How tight they are, how loose they are, determines a great deal on how much the drum rings. If they're tight, the drum is more dampened. You get more of a tight, crisp pop that way. If they're loose, you get more of a washy, loose sound. You can have a brittle or very warm drum depending just on the snares and just on how you have them set.
Well, there we go. Eric Lee, thanks so much for being with us. I thought I knew a lot about snare drums. Turns out I didn't know anything.
Well, I'm learning to this day. There's a lot more I'm learning, so that's the fun, just to keep learning.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Eric Lee paints and builds snare drums at his studio in Eau Claire. That interview with Al Ross aired on Spectrum West originally in October. This is Dean Kallenbach. Al's on vacation, hopefully to somewhere warm. So I've got the microphone this week as we enjoy some of the more interesting interviews of 2013 with artists, authors, and musicians with ties to Western Wisconsin. This is Spectrum West. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering home mortgage applications online, as well as information about the process, payment amounts, title insurance, mortgage insurance, and more. More at wisconsincu.org. Al Ross is back live next week, and among his interviews is one with a professor at UW-Barron County about the acoustic properties of bird communication. Join us for that. The state's Poet Laureate was created in 2000 by executive order of Governor Tommy Thompson. Since that time, stewardship of the Poet Laureate program has been taken over by the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters. On January 3rd of last year, the Academy announced its fifth Poet Laureate, and the next day, Al welcomed the honoree, UW Eau Claire English professor Max Garland, to Spectrum West.
Well, congratulations on the Poet Laureate honor, I think. I say that because I read the former Poet Laureate had 140 appearances last year.
Well, I didn't know that. Now I feel forewarned.
Yeah, well, you know, it's an honor tempered with reality.
Well, thank
I guess.
You. Yes, I'll keep that in mind.
Tell me about this former rural letter carrier thing that I read about. That's pretty neat, and it seemed to be a foundation.
The first book of mine was called The Postal Confessions, and it did draw from my experience almost 10 years running a rural mail route. On the route my grandfather ran, the route on which I was born, my parents lived, my grandparents, aunts and uncles. And for a long, long time, I wrote poems, I delivered mail. That was the way I thought a writer was supposed to live.
Cool. Grew up in Kentucky. So I'm wondering, does where one is raised influence how one writes or what one writes?
I would say most of the time that would be true. Yeah. It would be particularly if you grew up in a rural area, if you grew up with intimate contact with the natural world, if you grew up in an urban setting, those experiences might transplant themselves to different parts of the country. But I certainly think anyone who was growing up as a writer who did not pay attention to his or her surroundings would have a problem, really.
You established an interest in what you do as the letter carrier. Was there a little pilot light burning, do you think, prior to that when you were just a kid? Did you like to write at that time?
I would have never imagined that I would become a writer. As a matter of fact, as a kid, I didn't think there were writers, particularly poets. I didn't know. I thought poets were these antique beings who lived back in perhaps ancient Greece. I thought of them more like statues than human beings, and I thought you studied them as a part of the equipment of becoming an educated person, but I didn't know that you could actually be one at the time as a child. I think I was becoming interested in being a writer. I just didn't know it at the time. I didn't know there was such a thing.
They say that good comics, the best comics, are those who have suffered a little bit. What kind of prerequisites like that are necessary to be a good poet, do you think?
That's very interesting. I think that might be true of comics. But I don't think there's a way to avoid suffering. I think in my not-so-extensive study of religions of this world, it seems like one thing they have in common is they center upon that reality of suffering. So I don't think that comics or poets or musicians or artists necessarily suffer any more than other people. They often have a platform for articulating that suffering, mm-hmm. but I don't think your average poet suffers any more than your average truck driver or welder, although he may complain about it more.
One of the things I like about poets is that they blow the dust off words that we haven't used in quite a long time. And I keep running across the word wistful.
Wistful.
You know, and wistfulness. So that begs the question, does a person have to feel something in order to write a good poem?
Well, that's also a very good question. Almost any definition you would find of poetry, the word emotion would be in there somewhere. There would be language, something like the conveying of experiences, ideas, and emotions. And right at the center of poetry, and one of the things that often differentiates poetry from other forms of communication, business communication, for instance, is that emotion is really at the center of it. It's not on the periphery, but it's at the very center of it. And mm-hmm. it would be hard to think of a good writer, artist, or think about a musician, for instance, who did not feel things and did not try or feel the need to convey that feeling into his or her art.
Because most writers that I've talked to, and musicians as well, they admit that just like anything else, just like athletics, it's something that you have to practice, and you should do it every day.
That's true.
So you don't really have to muster volumes of emotion in order to write something every day, but maybe the ones that are founded on emotion are the best.
That could be the case. And what you just mentioned is, I think, particularly true of writing, and particularly true of things that aren't necessarily supported in a sort of wholesale, full and powerful way by the culture necessarily. You have to rely upon the habit that you formed. I wrote this morning. It wasn't very good. I hope no one ever sees it. I did yesterday morning and the morning before that. And you have to, in some ways, not take yourself too seriously, but if you want to be a writer or a musician or artist of any kind, mm-hmm. or craftsman, make wonderful furniture, you have to at least take that craft seriously. Mm-hmm. And you have to treat it as seriously as someone who wants to play violin or be a dancer. You can't just turn it on 3 or 4 months in the future. You have to be working at it as you go.
Do you think the words flow more freely when they're based on sadness or when they're based on cheerfulness?
That's a good question. I know that it's easier to write about sadness. If you talk to any 14-year-old who's writing poetry, he or she will say, I write when I'm depressed, I write when I'm sad. And I think it does lend itself. Perhaps it's just as simple as we need an outlet. We need something to do with this sadness, okay, rather than just cram it all inside or bore everyone else with it. And art is one of the things that people have used to cope with human suffering and sadness. Now, having said that, there is a long tradition of celebratory poetry. There are psalms and hymns and poems like that, but I think, personally, they're harder to write with a straight face.
Going back just a little bit, we were talking about suffering and wistfulness. You know, I asked the question, do you have to feel something in order to write a poem? Now, as I wrote that question, I also had the word effective in there. Do you have to feel something in order to write an effective poem? And then I wondered whether or not a poem even need be effective to be good.
Effective, that's interesting. Effective has, in its meaning, some connection with the result, how another person responds to it in some sense. And I suppose that is something of a personal thing. As I said before, people can't avoid suffering. And so everyone feels. People feel when they wake up. They feel when their children take off for school. They feel when they are angry. And it's not as if writers or poets make use of some special category of senses. It's the same range of senses that we all have. It's the same heart we all have. It's just a little more practice and motivation to talk about those things a bit more openly. However, there are tons of people out there who write poetry in private, who use it for their own purposes, who don't worry about how effective it is. They only write it because they need to, because it satisfies something within them. At some point, if you do that enough, if you take it seriously enough, some of those efforts that might be for your own purposes might actually become interesting to other people.
Well, you know, as poet laureate, I expect that I will have you back throughout some portion of the year, simply because that's quite an honor, and I have to tap that resource. So I look forward to having you back and asking you some of the other deep questions. But we should get on to the meat and potatoes of what it actually means to be the state poet laureate. How does a poet laureate plan his year?
My primary plan is to get up and try to write something that makes sense, or at least expresses something that's inside of me, and if it's no good, if it amounts to nothing, no one will ever see it. That's the great thing about writing poetry. An architectural mistake is very costly.
Yes.
You know, people have to live with it for a century. A poetic mistake is not. You can start over and over and over. And so my primary plan is to get up and write. I think an ongoing life as a writer is part of the responsibility of someone in this position. And the other is quite simple. It's to promote poetry and creativity among all ages, among the people of the state.
Can you envision this honor affecting how you write? The responsibility, does it put more pressure on you to be?
I hadn't thought of that, but now that you mention it, you know,
sorry,
I'm frozen with terror. No, luckily, I'm an early riser. I developed that habit as a rural mail carrier over 10 years. I woke up long before the sun. I was out there. And so even though I've been teaching at the university and the university here for a long time now, I still get up early. And so before any of these thoughts about task that might be attributed to the poet laureate come about, I'm just going to be writing. And I don't think it's necessarily going to affect that. I don't think it's going to help. Just because someone has appointed you to an honorary position, it doesn't necessarily make the words flow any better. It doesn't make you any smarter. I'm hoping it doesn't make me any dumber.
Well, even though you are transplanted, we do consider you a Western Wisconsinite. And as such, we're proud of your talent and your accomplishments. And again, congratulations on the honor.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That's Al Ross's interview with Wisconsin's poet laureate Max Garland of Eau Claire, which originally aired the day after he was named to that position for a 2-year term in January of last year. I'm Dean Kallenbach. Al's on vacation, so we're using this show to look back at some of the more fascinating 2013 interviews with personalities with Western Wisconsin ties. Never fear, Al's back next week with a live show that will include a look ahead to the Banbury Art Crawl, February 7th and 8th. In May of last year, we dedicated a full episode of Spectrum West to the career of Bruce Herring on the eve of his retirement, a band teacher who ramped up the jazz programs at Memorial, then North High Schools in Eau Claire, and brought both programs to national recognition. Several of Herring's bands were selected by the Lincoln Center for the Arts to participate in Essential Ellington, the Super Bowl of high school jazz festivals in New York City. This particular segment includes an interview Al did with one of Bruce Herring's prime pupils, Grammy Award-winning musician Justin Vernon, who came back in 2009 to perform in a fundraising concert to help that edition of the band travel to Essential Ellington, 10 years after Vernon himself had played with the first Memorial Jazz Band to participate in that festival.
The whole subject of public education in general, I think, is a pretty hot topic of late. There's obviously a bunch of issues and things like that, but the musical program at Memorial when I was coming up was geared towards building really good musicians. There's two educators there, in Bruce and in Steve Wells, extremely dedicated to their jobs and really cared about what they were doing and were allowed to be creative within their jobs and had foresight and believed in their kids and knew how to teach them and build them into great musicians. And I don't know, all my friends that I'm still tight with, you know, even if they're not doing music professionally, their music is still part of who they are. And it was very special. And like I said, it's all because of the dedication of those guys.
I had lunch with Bruce the other day, and he was telling me about the jazz band when you were in it. And it was kind of a neat little quirky thing that there were two Justins on guitar, and you guys had to switch off.
That's right. I couldn't make the cut as just the only one. The other guy was a lot better at reading charts than me, and he was just really had good tone. And we actually were in jazz one together, Jeff Dennegan and I, for 3 years.
Yeah, and he went on to be a doctor, I heard.
Yeah, I was more of a late bloomer in the success department. But
you're kind of surgical when it comes to music, I think.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks.
You know, he also had a wry smile on his face when he hauled out a couple of CDs of the band Mount Vernon.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, how cool was that to look at those jackets?
Well,
I didn't recognize you.
Me neither.
You were standing way in the back, too. That's the humility that's coming out there.
That's it.
Because of what you've done and where you've been, I have to ask this question about perspective. And I wonder if it's easy to lose perspective, or does it get more important to hang on to roots as things change in your life?
Well, I think it's good to grow. I think it's good to evolve. I think it's good to not hold on to the past too tightly.
Yeah.
But I definitely have some of that in me, a little bit of that nostalgic connection. And maybe it's not even nostalgia, it is a continuity, wanting to feel a continuity of a path through life. And maybe it's also just appreciation more than nostalgia. And I think Bruce, for instance, continued appreciating him. You know, we've done some things together since then, and I'd say we're friends now, you know, and he hasn't stopped being dedicated to music. I haven't stopped being dedicated to music, and I keep everything in perspective from the past and appreciate that it helped make me who I am. I guess in that sense, I hold on to it. Try not to hold on too tight. But
you got to let go in ways, and you got to hang on in others. If you're like me, it gets a little uncomfortable after you graduate from high school, and then a mentor of yours asks you to call them by their first name. That was weird for me.
It can be strange, but when you grow up, you just realize that teachers aren't some class of people from another planet. You know, they're somebody's kid and somebody's father, and, you know, so it puts things in perspective, too.
Yeah, and they shop for groceries, too.
That's right. They have to eat.
That's right. Yeah. Is there a little bit of Memorial High School jazz and a touch of Bruce in what you do and write today?
Oh, of course, yeah. I'm fully aware and appreciate that those experiences and some of the music, literally just some of the music theory that I learned and how a band with a bunch of people in it can make something really special by working hard at 15 seconds of music, knowing that you can always get it better. You can extend yourself and you can get it better, serving the song.
Yeah, I think what I've learned from most of the people I've talked to who've been touched by Bruce Herring is that they learned that hard work really does pay off.
Yes, that's right.
Tell me about how special was it in the reunion in 2009? How did that come about, and how did that feel to you?
I mean, that was one of the most bizarrely connected things that I'd ever done. I felt so lucky. I felt like I had just blinked and was just there going to high school, you know? It was so good to go back, and the kids reminded me of me and my friends hanging out in the band room, you know, and like just that camaraderie. And then the music was actually like, I was just blown away with how good the musicians were. You know, it kind of made me realize my chops had slipped a little bit in high school.
I bet you had a little special kind of nervous that night.
Yeah, it was. Well, anytime I don't get to have a guitar around my neck as sort of the comfort zone, it made me feel a little naked, I guess I'd say. Yeah, I wanted to do well because the band, like I said, the kids were so good.
Sure. Any parting message for Bruce Herring as he retires?
Well, I mean, I see him and I tell him I appreciate him all the time and all his hard work and everything. I think it's kind of apropos that he's leaving and he's a North graduate and he ended up having to go to North and finish out his career, but he's leaving such a big mark on so many lives, but also this musical community, and that won't ever go away.
Yours included.
Mine included, yeah.
That's Eau Claire's Justin Vernon, Eau Claire native and Grammy Award-winning musician, talking to Al Ross about his high school band teacher during last year's program dedicated to celebrating the teaching career of Bruce Herring at Memorial and North High Schools in Eau Claire. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony. Popular melodies, movie music, and show tunes abound in the concert American Music Through the Years, Saturday, February 8th at the State Theater. Details at 832-6366 or at cvsymphony.org. Jim Oliver is heard each week on Spectrum West as he surveys the theater and literary scenes of western Wisconsin. In November, he talked to an author who hails from Whitehall, though her life has since taken her many other places.
Callista Gingrich is the president of Gingrich Productions. She and her husband, Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, host and produce historical and public policy documentaries. She's a native of Whitehall, Wisconsin, where she was a member of the high school class of 1984. She is the author of three historical books for children, the most recent of which was released in early October. It's called A Yankee Doodle Dandy. Callista Gingrich joins us by telephone from the latest stop on her book tour in Downers Grove, Illinois, near Chicago. So we'll ask her to talk about her books, her other enterprises, and perhaps something about her life in Whitehall. Thanks so much for being with us today. Tell us about your writing. First, when did you get started writing? When did you decide that the writing bug had bitten you for real?
Well, thanks for having me, Jim. I began writing this children's series about 2 years ago, and my new book, Yankee Doodle Dandy, is the third volume in my Ellis the Elephant series. And this is a series that offers a guided tour of American history. And in Yankee Doodle Dandy, Ellis the Elephant, who is my time-traveling pachyderm, discovered the American Revolution and how America became a free and independent nation.
In the publicity and information that came ahead of us, talk about trying to make history more interesting for young people, because I think we all understand that a lot of history has been forgotten.
That's right. Well, it's vitally important that our children understand American history, including how our country began and what the first Americans faced. And unfortunately today, many of our children are failing to learn our American history, including our founding principles and values, and instead learning revisionist or politically correct history. And as a consequence, many children today are not learning the basics about our nation, especially about the American Revolution. And as we look at recent surveys, it's really quite sobering. Today, only 1 in 3 fourth graders can identify the purpose of the Declaration of Independence. And fewer than half of these fourth graders know why George Washington was an important American leader. So we have some work to do, and we owe it to our kids to give them the tools they need at an early age to begin to appreciate the greatness of this nation.
Now, Yankee Doodle Dandy is about the American Revolution. What are the first two books? What did they focus on?
Yes, well, my first book is called Sweet Land of Liberty. And in Sweet Land of Liberty, Ellis the Elephant discovers the pivotal moments that have made this country exceptional. And in my second book, Land of the Pilgrim's Pride, Ellis discovers colonial America, or how our nation began, which brings us to my third book, Yankee Doodle Dandy, which looks at the American Revolution.
I always enjoyed reading history, whether it be world history, American history, or whatever, but so many of my friends always said they hated history because it was so boring, it's just memorizing dates and that sort of thing. How do you think history could be better taught?
Well, I think in the case of young children, it's helpful to have a unique character to capture their attention. And in my case, I've chosen an elephant, Ellis the Elephant. And in writing this series, you know, I knew I needed a unique character, and I considered many animals, including bunnies and hippos and giraffes. But in the end, I could not resist this adorable little elephant, Ellis, who was brought to life beautifully by my illustrator, Susan Arciero.
Now, she has done all of the illustrations in all of your books, which are quite well done, by the way. I really enjoyed the pictures that went with the text in the book.
Yes, she has been my only illustrator, and she is very talented. I'm blessed to work with her, and we have a good partnership.
Now, Yankee Doodle Dandy is written in verse. Now, I haven't seen the first two, so did you write them all in verse?
Yes, they are all in verse, and herein lies the challenge. What we try to do is outline the story we want to tell, highlight the most important elements of whatever it is we are talking about, and also to convey the values that we feel are important, and to do that in two verses in rhyme in each illustration. So that is the challenge, and I usually go through 4 or 5 iterations of the text before I come to the final manuscript.
She is Callista Gingrich, who is the author of Yankee Doodle Dandy, the third in a series of historical books for children. Well, what is the age range that you're looking at for Yankee Doodle Dandy?
The age range for my series is technically 4 to 8 years of age. However, my mother, after reading these books, says 4 to 80 is more appropriate. And really, they are very good refreshers. And I have younger children and older children by them. But technically, we're looking at 4 to 8 years old.
You make an issue of including women in the historical narrative. Why do you suppose the role of women was so downplayed in American history for so many years? We all heard about Betsy Ross, and that sort of was the end of it.
That's right. Well, women did indeed play significant roles in winning our freedom. They not only supported our troops, but they actually fought. And in Yankee Doodle Dandy, Ellis meets many important American females, including Martha Washington, who was really vital to the health and well-being of General Washington. He also learns from Abigail Adams, who was not only John Adams' wife and best friend, but really his most influential advisor. He watches as Betsy Ross sews the first American flag. And Ellis also discovers Molly Pitcher, who takes over the cannon when her husband is carried off the battlefield, and she helps to win a decisive battle in the war for independence. So I feel it's very important for our children, and especially little girls, to learn that many women did play important roles in the creation of the United States.
You know, that can be tied into current times, I guess, as this is being recorded on Veterans Day, and so many women are left alone with their families while their husbands are off in far-off lands fighting the various wars that our country is involved in. And it struck me as I read about Abigail Adams, who was left alone by her husband when he was off helping build a nation.
That's right. She was left home to care for her family and her property, and at the same time to advise her husband as he was writing the Declaration of Independence. So she really did have a very important role.
Moving on to another topic, your photographs have been published as well. So what came first, the pictures or the prose?
Well, I've always loved photography. And it was actually my first Girl Scout badge, as I recall. My mom gave me a camera at a very early age, and I've always enjoyed it. And Newt and I have worked on projects together that have featured my photography. The one is called the book Rediscovering God in America, which takes a look at our nation's religious heritage from a historical perspective, and that's done through a walking tour of Washington, going to the monuments and the memorials, and my photography is featured in that book. The second book is Ronald Reagan, Rendezvous with Destiny, which is based on our documentary film, and some of my photos in that book are the photos that we took when we were on location, both in the United States and Europe, filming this documentary film. So I've really enjoyed photography, and I'm always looking for the latest in technology, and I'm always framing an image in my mind. It's just something I've really enjoyed.
Well, one of your high school classmates was quoted in the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram that he was surprised that you became a writer because you were a musician in high school. So what happened to the music?
Well, I'm still very active musically. In college, I was both a piano and French horn major, and I moved out to Washington to work for my hometown congressman right after college. I worked for Steve Gunderson for 7 years, and at that time, I really enjoyed the Hill, and I enjoyed politics, but I knew that my musical side needed to be fed as well, so I immediately auditioned for a choir. I was in the Capitol Hill Choral Society for many years. And in 1996, I auditioned at the Basilica of the National Shrine in Washington and became a member of the chamber choir there. So I'm still active at the Basilica. I sing every Thursday night and every Sunday. I also play French horn with the City of Fairfax Band, which is an ensemble in Fairfax, Virginia. So I've been very blessed to be a part of these organizations. It's a big part of my life, and I really enjoy it.
Well, I'm sure your past music instructors are happy to hear all of that. Tell me about life in Whitehall. Did you live in town? What kind of activities were involved in that city?
I grew up in Whitehall, Wisconsin, which is between La Crosse and Eau Claire. It's a town of about 1,500 people. And in a town that size, you really grow up doing many things. The school is very small, so, you know, all the kids are participating in the various programs. I played volleyball, I played in the band, I sang in the choir, I enjoyed doing forensics, I was a cheerleader. Everybody did a little of everything, and I was blessed to participate in so many extracurricular things growing up in Whitehall. But another thing that I really appreciate, having grown up in this beautiful town, it had a sense of patriotism. When I was little, every morning we said the Pledge of Allegiance, and we follow that up with a patriotic song. And I think that really had an important impact on my life as I was growing up. These are people who care about our country, and they want it to be America that we know and love. And I really am grateful for having that opportunity of having grown up in a place like Whitehall, Wisconsin.
We have been visiting with Callista Gingrich. Her book is Yankee Doodle Dandy, the third in a series of children's books that she has written about American history. The book is available in bookstores around Eau Claire and from online booksellers, including GingrichProductions.com. Callista Gingrich, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jim.
That's Spectrum West segment producer Jim Oliver and his interview from November with author and Whitehall native Callista Gingrich. Spectrum West is all about the arts, culture, and humanities of Western Wisconsin, and this week we're looking back at interviews from the past year, which include musicians, authors, and artists with Western Wisconsin ties. I'm Dean Kallenbach. Al's back next week live with a fresh set of interviews and inquiries about those sorts of things that make life in Western Wisconsin fun. Jenny Kaepernick and Bethany Valentini make up the duo The Ericksons. While they now base out of the Twin Cities, the sisters have roots in Western Wisconsin. Al Ross talked with Bethany Valentini in October, shortly after the release of their album, The Wild.
Did you guys play and sing together as kids and teens? I'm guessing you did.
Yeah, in a very different way. I mostly played the piano growing up, so I would just kind of like, we would have all the sheet music, you know, songbooks, and Jenny would sing, and we actually have an older sister, too, who would sing along, and I actually didn't start singing until, like, later in high school. My voice, like, changed over or something, but it was pretty brutal for a while. So yeah, a lot of music, and our dad was really, his work wasn't music-related, but he was always buying the latest, you know, CD and seeking out new artists, and so we were really exposed to a lot of good music growing up.
In the beginning, the formation of the Ericksons was full of emotion and purpose and dedication. Many entertainers talk about their early days with pride for having paid their dues and enduring lean times. Yours is a story that certainly has the hardship, but it's of a different color. Tell us and our audience briefly about the origins of who you guys are today.
Well, as you were alluding to, kind of the heartbreak of it all, I was married to an artist, Lee, and he passed away in 2006, which was kind of right when we were just sort of musically stirring a lot, and I was writing a lot, and Jenny and I lived together. Well, she came to live with me and with Lee when he was passing away, and so we were just together, you know, and he was a big supporter of even as loose as we, you know, were back then musically, and we had no real focus or direction, but he was a huge supporter of the sound or whatever he could even hear at that point, you know?
Sure.
So we just kept on with it, you know? Again, in life, I mean, there's nothing more intense than, you know, life and death stuff.
Right.
So,
yeah,
you know, when you encounter it so intimately and then moving forward from there, it was all... I just knew it was what I loved, you know, writing the music, and I knew it was what I would be committed to.
Uh-huh. Given all that stuff, you were a songwriter, you had some songs, Jenny, a musician as well, and obviously it appears that music is what got you guys through the rain.
Yeah, I think so. Plus a few other things, too, you know, just a lot of writing in general, but the music... You know, it's such a deep form of expression, such a true form of expression, you know, and I think anyone getting through a really difficult time or situation, I mean, if a person isn't kind of continually expressing where they're at, how they're feeling, what they're thinking, and just processing, I think you can get pretty stuck emotionally.
Yeah, no kidding. That's the voice of Bethany Valentini, who, along with Jenny Kaepernick, are a sister act called The Ericksons. It would appear that The Ericksons is kind of a tribute. Is that what it's meant to be?
You know, it wasn't. I think a lot of choices we make are subconscious. I really do, you know, because it is such a tribute. But how it came to be was we were playing at the same open mic in Brooklyn, New York, every Tuesday night, and we would get up and we would, you know, we'd say, "Oh, hey, I'm Bethany," and she'd say, "Oh, I'm Jenny." We didn't have our act together, if you will, you know. So we kind of put our heads together and said, "You know, we need to call ourselves something, so people know what to call us." My name at the time was Erickson, and she just said, "Well, why don't we be the Ericksons?"
I like it.
Is that right?
I read people didn't understand it in New York. There were not a lot of Scandinavians and stuff. You said,
right.
Yeah.
Well, it made it kind of exotic.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned Brooklyn. I read that you took a trip to India, then to Brooklyn, then you moved back to the Midwest. Was all that moving calculated to help you evolve, or were you just following your noses at the time?
Following our noses, for sure. every step we've taken, we've been true to this love of the music and this a deep pursuit, mm-hmm. of whatever it is. But it certainly hasn't meant we've, you know, known what we've needed all the time, or known, you know, where we would kind of end up. We always knew New York wasn't our home.
Sure.
But we had no idea how we'd get back to a home, or where the Midwest is our home.
Sure.
But the road was certainly not clear until it became clear.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, not intended, but a very nice, nice result. Yeah. When I listen to your stuff, and it's nice to listen to. One technique that I enjoy is the fact that your breathing is part of the rhythm of the songs.
Ooh.
And you know, I may be a sheltered musical hermit, but that feels unique to me. Is that kind of a natural tendency, or is it written into your stuff?
Very natural. Okay. And I think we'd have to just chalk it up to the being siblings, but also just singing together for so many years now, mm-hmm. and kind of following one another. You know, generally, I write the melodies, and Jenny, she can write any harmony, just supremely beautiful harmonies. You know, like when we perform live, it's a lot of interweaving, a lot of actively, you know, being together, singing together, finding that one breath.
Sure.
Which is kind of what it is then.
You do those little staccato things, and then you take a breath between each one, and it's kind of a step thing, and I think that's kind of neat.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Cool. That's Bethany, who along with her sister Jenny make up the duo called the Ericksons. Their new CD is called The Wild. And from that CD, here's a little bit of Gone Blind.
These eyes of mine have all but gone blind. I keep walking around, staring at the time. But my heart soars and my voice roars.
Bethany Valentini talked to Al Ross in October about the music career she shares with her sister Jenny Kaepernick as the music group The Ericksons and the album they released last year, The Wild. I hope you enjoyed this look back at some of the more interesting people we've had on Spectrum West in the past year. Next week, we're back live with Al Ross at the helm. He'll get us ready for the 2014 edition of the Banbury Art Crawl and share a segment about the acoustic properties of birdsong. Don't miss it. Thanks to Tiffany Coggins for production help and publicity for today's show. I'm Dean Kallenbach. Join us again next week at this time for your magazine about the arts and culture of Western Wisconsin, Spectrum West.